Even as many Americans are still coming to terms with the outcome of this year's presidential election, eyebrows are being raised on both sides of the aisle regarding some of the supporting players Donald Trump seems intent on surrounding himself with. Investigative journalist Sarah Posner has written about alt-right hero Steve Bannon and some of the others. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you for having me.
So, the list of unsavory characters surrounding the president-elect is pretty long, but Bannon has definitely gotten the most attention so far. Tell us why that is.
Well, it's largely because of the role that he's going to play and the power and influence that he will have in the White House. Sunday, when news started to leak of his appointment by Trump to be his chief strategist, the Trump camp first leaked news that they were going to make RNC chair Reince Priebus Trump's chief of staff, which typically is the most important job, you know, next to the president in the White House. And I think that that was a way of settling the media into the idea that, oh, maybe Trump is moderating or he's going more establishment or he's softening or he's pivoting. These are all things that we heard over the course of the campaign that actually never turned out to be true in terms of softening or pivoting or moderating. And then once the Trump camp sent out the press release announcing the appointment, Bannon's name was listed first, Priebus's name was listed second, and it said that they were going to be co-equal partners, the chief of staff and this chief strategist, sort of an unprecedented arrangement. Mm-hmm. Now, Bannon, before he joined the Trump campaign, was the chairman of Breitbart News, which is a far-right website that purports to be news but really is a lot of conspiracy theories and fake news and right-wing propaganda about immigrants, Muslims, African-Americans. So, you know, he basically went from Breitbart, which is basically a propaganda site, to being the CEO of the Trump campaign, to now possibly being one of the most powerful people whispering in the president-elect's ear.
When did you first start paying attention to this guy, and what made you decide to write about Steve Bannon?
It was clear over the course of the campaign that Breitbart was playing a significant role in being a cheerleader for Trump and Trump's campaign, both through the website and even through Bannon's Breitbart radio show that airs on SiriusXM daily. He no longer hosts the show, but before he was tapped to be the Trump campaign CEO in August, he was hosting that show on a daily basis or almost daily basis. So obviously, you know, you began to see over the course of the campaign that Breitbart was cheerleading for Trump's candidacy, you know, during the primary. And when I was covering the Republican National Convention, I went to a screening of Bannon's new film, which he made in conjunction with Citizens United. The two have a history of making films together. This is not the first film that Bannon had made with Citizens United. And, of course, Citizens United is the nonprofit whose movie about Hillary Clinton led to the Supreme Court case on campaign finance mm-hmm. that permitted unlimited corporate money in our political campaigns. So I went to the screening of this film, which would probably be of interest to your listeners. It features the Duck Dynasty patriarch Phil Robertson narrating a film that's ostensibly about the history of religious freedom around the world. So after the film that was screened at the RNC, there was a reception afterwards, and that's where I met Bannon and talked to him, and that's where he told me that Breitbart is the platform for the alt-right. So when Trump tapped him to be the CEO of his campaign about a month later in August, I wrote a story about Bannon and how, you know, some things that Breitbart has been publishing over the course of the campaign, the sort of race baiting, Islamophobic, propagandistic kind of quote unquote news that they publish. And that, you know, Trump had basically just tapped this person who boasted to me that his site is the platform for the alt-right. The alt-right, of course, being a relatively new political movement that advocates ethno-nationalism or white nationalism and is, you know, shot through with racism against African-Americans and against Muslims, and some elements of it are anti-Semitic, and some people in the alt-right advocate for a white ethno-state. So it was certainly newsworthy when the candidate Trump brought this person on to lead his campaign, and probably even more so that he tapped him to work in the White House.
Well, Sarah, what you know about Bannon, is he likely to bring the Breitbart news content to the White House and make the values or lack of values apparent in what he was doing there an issue for decision by the President of the United States?
Well, I think that the most telling insight we have into that is how Trump conducted his campaign.
Mm-hmm.
So over the course of the campaign, Rens Priebus was the chair of the RNC. Rens Priebus had the power on paper to rein in the candidate. He was the chair of the party that nominated this candidate, and he not only completely lacked the ability to rein him in, he in fact endorsed him, promoted him, praised him. Even while Trump hired Bannon to run his campaign. Now, obviously, Kellyanne Conway was the face of running the campaign. She was the campaign manager, but Bannon's title was campaign CEO, a title that most campaigns don't have, such mm-hmm. a person. And if you just look at the way Trump ran his campaign from August to November, did you see any evidence that he had been influenced by the quote-unquote establishment Republican at the helm of the RNC? No, all the evidence pointed to him being far more influenced by someone who wanted him to continue to demonize Muslims and immigrants and demonize the press, antagonize the press. So I don't see any history or precedent for Trump listening more to Priebus than to Bannon.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I'd also mention that this week, when Bannon has come under pressure by congressional Democrats, 169 of whom have written to Trump asking him not to appoint Bannon into the White House role, outgoing minority leader Harry Reid has also called on him, and numerous Watchdog and political advocacy groups have called on him to rescind this appointment.
Mm-hmm.
One of the issues raised about him is anti-Semitism. Then you've seen various people on the right defend him from anti-Semitism. And if you looked at Breitbart yesterday or the day before, you might have seen articles focusing on these defenses of Bannon from these charges of anti-Semitism and racism without any mention of Bannon's actual connection to Breitbart.
Mm.
So, very interesting and telling. And if anyone thinks that Rens Priebus is going to have any say over Bannon in Trump's White House, I have a bridge mm-hmm. I can sell them.
2 or 3 weeks ago, one of our guests said, reality is under siege.
Mm-hmm.
It's really frustrating that in what many people are now calling the post-factual era, we're seeing a large number of Trump fans trying to downplay Bannon's extremist and very recent past. Sarah, how is it possible to just sort of reclaim the relevance of actual facts, of truth, or is it too late for that?
Well, you know, post-truth is the Oxford Dictionary's word of the year for 2016. This is a reckoning in our culture and our society. Our news cycle was influenced by just an avalanche of fake news, some of it perpetrated by Breitbart, a lot of it just disseminated on social media, shared and retweeted by people who were gullible to it, but also in some instances shared and retweeted by Trump campaign staff. You know, we're just awash in propaganda and fake information and gaslighting, right? So what you're seeing now, despite all the evidence that Bannon at the very least ran a website that peddled in horrible, like, race baiting and Islamophobia and anti-immigrant bashing, all of it, now you're seeing people come to his defense, and often the defense is very similar to the defense that we saw of Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. That, oh, here's a person who knows Steve Bannon personally. He doesn't have a racist bone in his body. He doesn't have an anti-Semitic bone in his body. Well, these are the same defenses that we heard in particular from leaders on the religious right who endorsed Trump when they were asked, well, what about his history of philandering or boasting about sexually assaulting women, mm-hmm. or, you know, cheating on his wives, or, you know, the list goes on and on. And their response very often was, well, we're all sinners, or I know him personally, and he's very dedicated and devoted to his family, and he's a great family man. And don't listen to all of this other stuff, because I know him personally. These are the things that people are saying mm-hmm. to defend Steve Bannon now. Mm-hmm. It's the same method of defending him in the face of all of this evidence right in front of your eyes that you can see with your own eyes and hear with your own ears. Here I am. I'm going to tell you that this is an honorable man.
Sarah, my conclusion about the religious right is they have shown us without question that winning is more important than faith and that politics trump morality. He got 81% of the evangelical Christians vote. Do you think President-elect Trump feels like he owes the Christian right something?
Yes and no. But remember Mike Pence. So I think that Trump personally does not care about the religious rights issues. I mean, we saw in that first interview he did with Leslie Stahl in 60 Minutes where he said Obergefell, the Supreme Court's decision striking down same-sex marriage bans, is unconstitutional. He described that as settled law. That's like a shocking thing to the mm-hmm. religious right. Like, I think that they would hold out hope under the current political circumstances that they may be able to get in sufficient numbers of Supreme Court justices that it might be overturned, right? Just mm-hmm. like they would like to overturn Roe v. Wade. You know, I think that that certainly has to be a signal to them that he is not really focused on their issues. Now, of course, out of the box, the things he's probably going to do is to try to repeal Obamacare, something about deportations and building the wall. These are not the religious rights priorities, but you can imagine a scenario where there's so much attention focused on those things happening. I mean, repealing Obamacare is a priority for the religious right, but, like, it's not specific mm-hmm. to them. And for the things that are specific to them, you could see a scenario happening where there's so much attention being paid to Trump trying in his first 100 or 200 days to push through an Obamacare repeal and a bunch of immigration restrictions and wall-building kind of legislation and policy that more under the radar, the religious right may get some things done because Mike Pence is able to somehow accomplish these things for them while Trump is busy being focused on other things. So, you know, you could imagine a scenario where Pence would go to Trump and say, look, you know, we've got to do this thing. We've got to reverse the contraception coverage requirement under the Affordable Care Act, or we've got to push through the Russell Amendment, which is an amendment to the defense bill that would basically allow religious discrimination among defense contractors, you know, and in federal contracting. So on the one hand, you could see Trump delegating these things to Mike Pence, which would be really good news to the religious right, to just mm-hmm. have all of those issues that they care about delegated to Mike Pence. He is their ally. He is trusted and known to them. On the flip side of that, and I think this is something we don't know for sure yet, right? Trump may end up delegating those things to Pence. On the other hand, Trump may also be too much of a control freak to delegate things to anybody else. Mm-hmm. So that's, like, a little unclear at this point whether he would actually delegate these things to Pence or not. I think the question is how much he really actually cares about doing something on those issues and how much he actually cares about paying back the religious right for showing up at the polls for him. I think the person who probably cares about that more than Donald Trump does is Mike Pence. Mm-hmm. And so I think that the power dynamic between the two of them is going to be really important to watch to determine how much the religious right is going to actually get in quid pro quo.
Sarah, we already know enough to be disturbed all the time. Are there aspects of the presidential transition that you're not seeing in mainstream media, but that your own work causes you to worry about?
Well, I think that one of the things that we don't know about and is completely undercovered, because I think there's just so much else happening right now, but this is something you and I have talked about many times, Obama's Office of Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships. Now, of course, Obama made a lot of changes to that office that strengthened constitutional protections over what had been in place during the Bush era. And all of that is good, but all of that is still in place. And I think there's a really big question of what would a Trump-Pence administration do with an Office of Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships. I think it's going to look a lot different than Obama's Office of Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships, which was very focused on reaching out to a wide, diverse array of faith communities. And when I say diverse, I mean both racially diverse and religiously diverse, to address issues like climate change and poverty. I don't know like how much they actually got done. I mean, I think a lot of it was for show. But the fact is that office still exists and still exists to be inherited and molded by Donald Trump and Mike Pence. And I think it would look a lot different than it did under Obama with the two of them in charge of it. And I suspect that it would make the Bush Office of Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships look tame.
Sarah Posner is an investigative journalist at the intersection of religion and politics. Her writing appears in Rolling Stone, The Washington Post, The New York Times, The Huffington Post, and elsewhere. Sarah's the author of God's Prophets, Profits, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values Voters. Sarah, it's really important right now to have the perspective of someone who's been paying close attention to these characters since well before the election. Thank you for being with us again today on State of Belief Radio.
Thanks for having me, Welton.